Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My guest today is John Schwaller, who has written the book The 15 Months, which I'm holding up right here, which is an excellent account on the Aztec religion, which I am going to talk about today. I'm sorry, again, I want to correct myself. I did say fifth month. I meant to say 15th month. There's another book called The Fifth Son, and sorry for confusing that title. But The 15th Month is a book about Aztec religion. And I want to begin with, there's a perfectly fine reason why you called it The 15th Month. So let's get into that first. Why chose to call the book The 15th Month?
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here to talk with you. The 15th month was a decision that the publishers and I made because it has a certain shock value. We think about the European calendar having 12 months. And so when somebody gives a number that's larger than 12, it takes us aback. The Mexica, the folks who we now know as the Aztecs, shared a calendar with many other native peoples of what is now Mexico. It was a solar calendar, but rather than having 12 months of more or less 30 days, as we do in the European system, they had 18 months of 20 days, and then an additional week of 5 days that were not ascribed to any particular month, but were dedicated to certain rituals having to do with the solar calendar. And so very quickly you realize that, no, there aren't 12, there are 18 months, and each of them is 20 days. The other major difference is that a week was 5 days long, so there were still 4 weeks in each month. And so the periodicity of celebrations, of market days, of all of the activities that we associate with normal daily life, we're on a 5-day schedule rather than on a 7-day schedule.
So let's begin with some sources, because as you mentioned in the book, there is mostly Christian sources that we use. And we talked a little bit about this before the recording, but as you know, they did have somewhat literacy, but not to the extent that we had in the European world. But, you know, I want to talk about the Christian sources mainly, as you those are the main sources you use for your book. But can you really rely on the Christian sources? Are how much of the source in Christian that you use from the Christian world is propaganda that they want to show, you know, that the Christianity is the true religion, and that how barbarians the Aztecs were, to put it that way.
Well, those of us who work in the field find ourselves in a situation where, obviously, it's something that happened 500 years ago, and so we have to use whatever documentation we happen to have. As it turns out, the largest volume of information was written down by Europeans, individuals. And by and large, these men were members of Christian religious orders. They tended to be Franciscans. Father Diego Duran was a Dominican. And so, yes, you're absolutely correct. We have to be extremely cautious how we use these materials, because we need to make certain that we do not carry the taint of Christianity, as it were, into our understanding of the native peoples of what is now Mexico. For that reason, it's important to understand Spanish Christianity of the time. And I'm kind of lucky because I've already written several books on the Catholic Church in 16th century Mexico. So for 20, some 30 years, I was immersed in Christian thinking of the period and the way the church was organized. So it gave me a little bit of an additional insight into possible Christian references when the friars who were writing down their impressions of the native religion were getting off track and perhaps comparing it to Christianity or introducing information that was not really part of the native religion. So yes, we have to be very careful. It is a fairly fine line that we walk, but I think most of us who work in the period are fairly confident that we do have a good understanding of the native religion. Part of it is also what a historian does normally, and that's that we triangulate. We try not to base all of our work on a single source. And certainly on my book, The 15th Month, I was blessed by the fact that we have four or five fairly high quality sources that talk about the rituals and the ceremonies of this particular month of the Mexica calendar. So we aren't relying completely on Bernardino de Sahagún, although he is a major figure and provides the bulk of the information that I use. But we also have Diego Durán. We also have Toribio de Mendavente, who is known as Motolinía, and a few other smaller sources. So we triangulate wherever we possibly can, which is to corroborate information with other sources.
Hmm. Now let's begin with the Aztec mythology. We one of the most infamous gods of the Aztec world, which is Huitzilopochtli, and there are a few others, but he is going to be our main guy, so to speak. So let's talk about how the birth of Aztec mythology and how Huitzilopochtli became to be one of the most famous gods in the Aztec religion.
Right. Huitzilopochtli, which translated into English means hummingbird on the left, was the national god of the Mexica. He was adopted by them, and he adopted them during the Mexica migration, which occurred over some 200 years. When they left their ancestral homeland in what is now the northwest of Mexico and slowly migrated into the central, more well-watered part of the country. And it's during that migration that they adopt Huitzilopochtli, or depending upon how you want to look at it, Huitzilopochtli adopts the Mexica in an intimate relationship. In that sense, to use a Christian analogy, it is not unlike Yahweh and his relationship to the Jewish people. It's a very intimate and close relationship. And many of the traditional sources describe this conversation, if you will, between Huitzilopochtli and the Mexica as they migrate into the central part of the New World. He was only one of several gods in the Mexica panoply. Mexica were individuals who spoke the language Nahuatl, and most of the people who ended up living in central Mexico also spoke Nahuatl, but came from slightly different historical traditions. There are some non-Nahuatl speakers in what is now the Valley of Mexico, the Central Basin, from Otomangean language speakers, Otomi. But by and large, most folks spoke Nahuatl. And so when we talk about the various different nations, all of whom who spoke Nahuatl, we call them the Nahua, because they have a common language, they have a common calendar, they have a common panoply of gods. Some of them are more important some places, and others are more important in other places. But certainly for the Mexica, there was a close relationship with Huitzilopochtli. Many of the individuals who were already in the central basin of Mexico had Tezcatlipoca as their principal deity. Tezcatlipoca means the smoking mirror. He was also a militaristic and trickster god, an omnipotent deity. And in many of the creation...
Sorry for interrupting, Daniel, but mm-hmm. it was kind of like Loki, in a sense, from Norse mythology.
not trying to draw too many European comparisons. But there is, one could see that he and Loki are perhaps cut from the same cloth. There's also a tradition in the American, in the Southwest of the United States, of a trickster god. And so this very much fits the personality of Tezcatlipoca. He also is an oracle, and he also is one of a supreme deity. Some of the creation myths give him four different aspects. One for water, one for fire, one for air, and controlling more of the natural world. So in general, at least what I have found in my book, was that there were large numbers of nations who had Tezcatlipoca as a central deity in their panoply of gods, whereas the Mexica had Huitzilopochtli as the central deity in their panoply.
And I'm sorry for getting some. And I'm sorry, I'm probably going to say this name wrong, but they also did have a fire god, which was Xiuhtecuhtli. I'm sorry if I'm saying it wrong, and probably sounds horrible, but let's talk about Xiuhtecuhtli as well.
Yeah, Xiuhtecuhtli, which means fire god or the fire lord. It can also mean the Green Lord. He was an important deity, but by no means generally considered central. He's generally depicted as an old man with a brazier in his lap. He's got wrinkled skin and missing teeth. He was an important deity, but more of a household and common deity. The other principal deities included the sun, the solar disk itself, Tonatiuh, who sometimes is represented as Huitzilopochtli. Sometimes Tezcatlipoca is associated with the movement of the solar disk. The other very, very, very important deity is Tlaloc, who is an earth god, who is associated with rain. And in fact, in downtown Tenochtitlan, which was the capital of the Mexica, the Great Pyramid was dedicated to two deities, to Huitzilopochtli on one side and Tlaloc on the other. So they were in many ways seen as being equally important in the Mexica panoply.
I'm sorry, I know you want to try to explain this as much as possible. I can't help myself. But compared with the Greek mythology, was the stories like, you know, with the Greek gods, how they came to be, how they created the earth, were there that kind of stories in the Mexica world as well?
There were some, but they were very, very, very different. Fortunately, in this instance, we don't see that, you know, Jupiter was associated with Tezcatlipoca, and so they just had all of the same stories. No, the stories are really quite different and quite locally associated with the Mexica and with other Nahuatl-speaking peoples of central Mexico. There are several creation myths. The one that I particularly like is one which the Mexica used in order to explain the creation of the current era of humanity. According to the Mexica, humanity have gone through four different creations. The gods destroyed the world at the end of each of the four creations, which is why my colleague Camilla Townsend has her book, The Fifth Sun. Because we are in the fifth sun, we are in the fifth creation. And that creation occurred at Teotihuacan, which is the large group of pyramids located to the north-northeast of Mexico City. And there the gods assembled. When there was no day, there was no night. And the gods resolved to create the world. And so they made a huge bonfire, and they asked two different gods to immolate themselves in the bonfire in order to go through an apotheosis to become the solar disk. One of them, a fine and lovely noble, was happy to do so. And so he leaped into the fire and was transformed into the solar disk. The other god, Tecuhistecatl, who is called the pimply-faced god, who was ugly and awful and badly dressed, finally was encouraged to jump into the fire and immolated himself. And he also became the solar disk. But unfortunately, with two sons, there was no time for rest. And so one of the gods, Quetzalcoatl, was tasked with catching an animal in order to throw it up into the heavens to darken one of the disks. And so Quetzalcoatl caught a rabbit, and he threw it up into the sky, and it landed on the face of the pimply god of Tecuhistecatl, and it became the moon. The light was diminished. And so when you look up at the moon, what you see is a rabbit sitting, looking off to the right. So that's one of the creation myths that I particularly like.
Hmm. There's another myth that I want to go into before we go into the Aztec Mexico people themselves, and that is, of course, the creation of Huitzilopochtli and how he became a god, which I feel like we should go into as well.
Right. The birth of Huitzilopochtli really is central to the study that I had of the 15th month. According to the story, his mother, Coatlicue, her snakes, her skirt, was sweeping atop the main temple to the gods, and she was cleaning. And as she did, a puff of eagle down floated onto the temple. And so she put it into her pocket in order to keep the temple clean. The eagle down turned into a child, and she recognized that she was pregnant, and she was pregnant with Huitzilopochtli. Of course, her other children, the main child was Coyoshauki, which we can translate as jingle bells her cheeks.
That's such a lovely name.
Yes, was infuriated that her mother was pregnant, essentially out of wedlock, and swore to kill the child. And she enlisted her brothers, who are known as the 400 Southerners, the Tzenzonwitznawa, to kill the baby inside of Coatlicue. However, Huitzilopochtli, the baby, understood what was going to happen, and so he emerged fully armed and battled his sister and brothers. He killed his sister, he chopped her head, arms, and legs off and threw her from the temple, and he defeated his brothers, the 400 Southerners, and routed them, and came to reign supreme.
Now, before we go into the sacrifices, of course, I want to talk about, because as we talked a little bit about the mythology right now, so I want to talk about the priesthood, because, of course, priests were a very important part of the Mexican tradition. But I want to talk about the education to becoming a priest, and who can become a priest in the Mexico, for the Mexico people? Was it one of the toughest jobs to get, or how easy was it to become a priest in the Mexican world?
Well, generally speaking, the priesthood was limited to individuals from the upper reaches of society, and they went off to a special priestly school from about the early teens, and they studied the priestly rituals, they studied the calendar, they studied the almanacs, and became highly sophisticated scientists in the sense of being able to predict natural phenomena, sunrises, sunsets, equinox, solstices, eclipses, and the movement of the major and lesser stars. So it was a rigorous and highly, I think you'd have to call it scientific training. They were generally cloistered off from the rest of society, and interacted during the major rituals and celebrations.
So you something that you mentioned in the very start of them. Of the book is that there was a ritual with running, so that got you kind of fascinated with writing the book in the first place, I believe. So what was the deal with the running and the priest kind of marathon in a sense?
Right. Well, the way I got interested in the 15th month was actually due to a dear friend of mine, Susan Schroeder, who had written an article about the Aztec Valentine. And that was a story from Aztec history, from Mexica history, wherein the emperor Huitzilihuit had gone down to Cuernavaca, Cuauhnahuac, in order to find a princess to marry. The princess was supposed to be beautiful and wonderful. Unfortunately, her father, the lord of Cuauhnahuac, was a powerful wizard, and he kept her isolated and away from the rest of society. And so Huitzilihuit made an arrow, and he put a jade bead in it, and he shot the arrow through the sky, and it landed in the compound of the young maiden and broke apart, and she saw the jade bead and tested it with her teeth in order to make certain it really was jade, because jade's a very hard stone, and accidentally swallowed it. And she became pregnant with Moteoctezuma Ilhuicamina, who was the older of the two Mexica emperors known as Montezuma. And his sobriquet, his second name, Ilhuicamina, means sky arrow. So he carried some of that with him. Anyhow, Susan wrote a delightful article talking about the role of women and society and the structure of society based on this event. And as I was reading about the various celebrations in the Mexica year, I was taken with the celebrations surrounding the raising of banners, Pan Quetzalistli, which is the 15th of the 18 months. Because the central ritual there is a priest who takes an amaranth dough image of the god Huitzilopochtli, and then he runs a marathon. It's actually about 20, I roughly calculated it to about 22 or 23 miles. It's a little bit shorter than a marathon, from the main temple in downtown Tenochtitlan to the ritual ball court, up to Tlatelolco, then over west to near Azcapotzalco, running along the shore to the heights of Chapultepec, then down to Coyoacan, and then up the central causeway back into Tenochtitlan. And it was the central ritual. And I was thinking to myself, what does this tell us? And after having given a paper at a specialized conference, it was almost uncanny. A couple of people asked me questions, and all of a sudden I had a book outlined in my head, and I wrote it down, and it became a 15th month. So I like to say that this book chose me rather than me choosing the book. It just kind of appeared, not unlike Venus fully armed out of the head of Zeus.
So of course,
or Huitzilopochtli fully armed out of
So, of course, sacrifices are a big deal in the Mexican world. And I believe I read somewhere, I don't remember where, but I do think the number of total sacrifices is 80,000. Is that correct? Is that ever exaggerated? Or is do we kind of take this number for granted? Is it really 80,000 sacrificials that we can count of, or is it more? Or what's, yeah. what's, do we have a certain number?
Okay, let me work on this a little bit. We are undergoing, needless to say, a reevaluation of so many things in Mexica life, in Aztec life. And one of them that we have been focusing on, and there hasn't been a lot of work published yet, but I anticipate in the next few years there will. And that is the role of what Europeans have come to know as sacrifice. It is an important issue to tackle because just as you suggested at the beginning of our conversation, much of what we know about the Mexica and other native peoples of what is now Mexico is colored by the friars who came to Christianize them. And increasingly, those of us who work in the field are stepping back and looking at what the friars called sacrifice and beginning to associate it slightly differently than what the friars did. Mm-hmm. The mechanics are essentially still the same. Yes, people were taken on top of pyramids and their hearts were extracted and offered to the deity. A radical cardiectomy is what one of my colleagues has called it. What we're beginning to move away from is the idea that these individuals are being sacrificed. While, yes, they are being killed, we're looking more closely at who those individuals are. And I certainly have begun this conversation in my book, mm-hmm. where we see that the individuals who are being executed are outsiders. They are unequivocally soldiers from opposing nations, and in some instances, they are slaves from other nations who, for one reason or another, are being punished by the state. And so what we're trying to do is to put some of this into a little bit larger context of human confrontation of the other, of humans dealing with political issues using the ultimate action, which is execution. And historically, particularly Europeans have said, oh, how awful, you know, their hearts were ripped out and all this blood. Well, yes, this is very true. I don't think we would want this to happen to anyone near and dear to us or even far and not dear to us. But at exactly the same time, and perhaps for 200 or 300 centuries later in Europe, we have public beheadings. We mm-hmm. have individuals who are ritually disemboweled. We have
burned at the stakes.
Burned at the stake. We have tied to horses and ripped apart while they are still alive. We have a rather significant number of brutal, gruesome, grisly, bloody executions.
And not to speak of creative torture.
Exactly, at the same time. So what those of us who study the Mexica are starting to do is say, okay, let's calm down. Let's think of these more as executions to serve a religious purpose, but as executions, individuals who have run counter to the rules of society, and that particular society has chosen to execute them. Not unlike the Inquisition burning people, not unlike the Scottish leaders being beheaded and disemboweled by British troops, not unlike any other inhumanity that man has meted on to his fellow.
And if I may interrupt you again, I want to add as well that in the Tower of London, even in the 19th century, I believe, they played cricket with the heads of the people they were hanging after they were hung. So if you want to talk about barbarity, just look at the Tower of London, how they treated the dead after they were hanged in the 19th century, as late as just 300 years ago.
Yes, well, and we have Madame la Guillotine in the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. We have witches being burned in the 18th and 19th centuries. So, yeah, we are not that far removed as civilized Europeans from the same barbarity. Again, this is not to apologize for the Mexica. This is not to make light of the fact that they were executing humans. But I think we as individuals from a Western tradition need to step back and take a deep breath and look more profoundly at what's going on. And again, we, as you rightly pointed out in our very first words, we need to look and see what the observers from the Spanish side in the 16th century were implying in their descriptions to us.
Now, you mentioned, and I want to talk a little bit about this, you mentioned that most people were outsiders, and something you write about in the book as well is, of course, wars, which wasn't uncommon in Mexico world as well. So, and you mentioned that most sacrifices were, of course, a lot of them were POWs, and there were not just wars for territorial gains necessarily, but there were also wars to get prisoners to I'm sorry for calling it again, sacrificial reasons, yeah, that they were having racial wars against other tribes.
Yes, we again, this is an area of fruitful research. There was a type of stylized warfare which was known as the Xochiayot, which means the flower war, in which the ostensible reason was to gain prisoners from the other side. We are not sure, but it has long been assumed, thanks to the writings of the 16th century friars, that these individuals were destined for sacrifice. We don't know for sure, because we have not, we just don't have the kinds of records that would tell us Cuauhtecutli from Tlaxcala ended up on the sacrificial stone in Mexico City. We just don't have those kinds of records. What we do know is that prisoners were taken. We do know that those prisoners were brought back to Mexica land, back to the Central Basin. And we know that they became members of households of the warriors who had captured them. We also know that there are captured warriors who are sacrificial victims. We don't have the absolute connection except for the 16th century friars telling us that. So we don't have much reason to doubt it, but at the same time, we don't have solid confirmation.
And I would add that further question to that, because now if you were, so for lack of a better word, a citizen of Texcoco or any other cities under the Aztec, you were pretty much safe. You weren't going to be sacrificed, right? They weren't going to come knock on the door. Okay, we need a sacrifice to official victims. We're going to choose you next.
Absolutely not. However, you could be captured by the Tlaxcalans or by the Cholulteca or another group and potentially be executed in their land. So no, for everyone, it was a peaceful world in the sense that no one was coming around to bother you. But there were very clear public executions going on around the calendar, depending upon the needs of the rituals.
And something you talk about extensively as well is merchants that travel to make trades for slaves. Yes. And for sacrificial purposes for a living. Yeah. As well. So let's talk a little bit about the merchants that travel around. And as you mentioned, taking prisoners outside, were the merchants safe from becoming prisoners themselves, or was it a very dangerous job, considering that you could perhaps be caught as a prisoner yourself? Or were you, did you have political immunity as a merchant?
Right. The merchants are very important, in particular in the rituals of the 15th month of Panquetzaliztli, because by the end of the Mexica Empire, by the period immediately prior to the arrival of the Spaniards, the merchants had been lifted up socially and politically to a position almost equal to the warriors, and they became central figures in the celebrations of the 15th month. There were several kinds of merchants in the Mexica world, not unlike in the modern world. You have your retail merchant, the guy who has a shop, buys and sells goods for the public. And then you have wholesale merchants who get material from manufacturers, and then they sell it to the small shopkeepers. The types of merchants that we're addressing here were those wholesale merchants, merchants who would fund expeditions to far off places in order to get rare goods, feathers, gemstones, dye stuff, exotic foods, animals, all of the luxury items in general, and some construct and some basic materials. And so they would be merchants who would go out hundreds of miles away to acquire goods for sale back in Tenochtitlan. The merchants were, by and large, given immunity by most of the nations of what is now Central Mexico, for the simple reason that they were all interdependent. All of the different native nations needed trade in order to not just survive, but certainly to excel, because it was the merchants who were especially specializing in rare and costly goods. So they were a needed resource within the society. And so they were given a general political immunity, if you will, from warfare and whatnot. But as a result, the merchants were also used as spies and diplomats. They would come back to Tenochtitlan and tell the leadership what was going on out in distant provinces. So they were a wonderful information gathering network. And so they were spies, but they were also diplomats. They would help to negotiate between potentially warring nations to assure that there were no misunderstandings. So they had a very special role within Mexica society, because in many ways, they were as important as the military in terms of expanding the empire and assuring that the empire had the precious goods that it wanted for the benefit of its internal economy.
And let's talk about another thing that you talked about as well is during the sacrificial ritual is the bathing before. But before we do, I want to go back a little bit before the bathing, because I have another question to add to that, because, you know, there were, as far as I understand it, I'm not sure if even that's the number where I read this, but before you become sacrificed, some of the victims would become the god themselves, and they would walk around as gods, and people would genuinely believe. So how did that work in when you became a god and then you were after how long time did this go on for after it became a draw?
Yes, there in for the celebrations of different months, there were different rituals in which society engaged. In several of them, an individual who had been chosen for execution was dressed in the regalia of a specific deity and lived a month or 3 months or 4 months as that deity. They wore the raiment of the deity. They wore the headdress and all of the other accoutrements of the deity. And they were considered an embodiment of the deity. For all intents and purposes, they were the deity. This is called Ishiptla in Nahuatl. A dear friend of mine has translated that as the local embodiment of a deity. This is Molly Bassett, who's done just superb work on the Ishiptla. But there are many different kinds of Ishiptla, that is a local embodiment of the deity. And in fact, in the rituals of Panquetzaliztli, the amaranth dough figure, which plays an important role in the running ceremony, is also an Ishiptla. It is a local embodiment of Huitzilopochtli. So it is imbued with all of the powers of the deity in that ceremony. So there is this concept of Ishiptla, wherein an individual is a local embodiment, a representative, if you will, of the deity that they are dressed up like. And certainly in the celebrations of Panquetzaliztli, in addition to the amaranth dough image, there is evidence that some of the individuals chosen for execution wear different parts of the garb of Huitzilopochtli, in that they are being associated with the deity prior to their execution.
Did the victim itself believe that it was, oh, I am the god, and did it just go along with it for the sake of it?
Who knows? We don't have any interviews with them.
I mean, it wouldn't make sense, like, oh, since I'm the god, shouldn't you let me go? That's what I would have done. If I became god, I wanted to get sacrificed. I'm a god, you should let me go, be free. Not by sacrificial means, but I wouldn't mean go out to... I was in the free world. I let me wander and see the world.
It again, what we're dealing with is a completely different mentality and worldview. And so individuals obviously reacted to much of this quite differently than you and I would, given that they had been prepared since childhood, indoctrinated, if you will, in this belief system. So that I can't tell you. That lies beyond my powers as a historian. Sorry.
That's fine. But I mentioned before we got into the day, becoming the deity as well, bathing was, of course, important to the sacrificial ritual as well. So let's talk about the bathing for the ritual.
Right. One of the unique features of the Panquetzaliztli rituals is that the individuals who were chosen for execution were ritually bathed as part of the preparation for their execution. And they were taken to a very special spot south of Mexico City near what is now Churubusco, it was known as Huitzilopochtli. It was known as the place of Huitzilopochtli. And they were ritually bathed. And minor sacrifices were done at that time. The bathers would prick their fingers. They would have small amounts of blood let out of their ears, earlobes. There were other small rituals that went on during the bathing. The bathing was a necessary precursor to them taking on part of the image of the deity. And so the bathing, the altia, was an important precursor to the later events. What we also recognize is that there was a second type of bathing, which is to be ritually bathed with sand, the Shalakia. And in fact, the area in front of the central pyramid in the central temple in Tenochtitlan was a sandy area. And we believe that there was an additional sand bathing that occurred at that point prior to the final execution. So while the water bathing is clear, the sand bathing is something that we're still wrestling with.
Something that I found kind of surprising and a little bit gross as well is that we talked a little bit about this, and then talked about the sacrifice itself before we go into the aftermath of the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Well, the radical cardiectomy. Yes, the execution occurs on the top of the great temple. There are five priests involved. Four of the priests grab the arms and legs of the person being executed. The fifth priest has a flint knife. The person being executed is flexed over a stone, which means their chest is raised and their arms and legs pulled down. As best we know now, as a result of some scientific study, is that the knife was inserted under the rib cage at the diaphragm and then deftly thrust up, cutting the major arteries and veins so that the heart was extracted very quickly. Not according to the friar's accounts, while it was still beating. So that's the process. It's rather gross, but you know, ritual disembowelment is not funny.
Pretty. So of course, another thing that's kind of gross is what they did with the body and the heart afterwards, because cannibalism, of course, was as well a part of the sacrificial ritual.
Yes. Again, we have to go back and check our sources. The degree to which human flesh was consumed is open to a great deal of speculation, if any of it were consumed at all. And there are a lot of people who believe that human flesh was not consumed. From the accounts that I have worked with, it is my understanding that there might be small parts of human flesh which were consumed by the individual who was the sponsor of the individual who was executed, by the warrior who had provided the sacrificial victim, or by the merchant who had provided the candidate for execution. So it seems to me that this is most logical, most reasonable in the context. I have never believed that human flesh was a source of nutrition among the Mexica.
A delicacy.
It was not. If it was consumed at all, it would have been a very small piece, generally from the thigh or buttocks, that was consumed with corn.
I don't know if buttocks would be my first choice, but hey. Whatever you prefer.
Yes. Well, all I know is what I read in the sources. And again, you know, going back to that question that you first asked me, we have to be very careful with these sources. It's quite possible that there was no consumption of human flesh at all, because the friars misunderstood what was going on, and it was the most abominable thing that they could think of, and so they ascribed it to the Mexica. So the jury is actually still out on that.
So, of course, another thing I wanted to talk about as well is alcohol that you write about in the book, which I found interesting, that it wasn't widely distributed as in the European world, but even if you were caught drinking alcohol, if it was just for a certain few people. So if you were caught, it was a very severe punishment if you were caught drinking in secret. So they're talking about the distribution of alcohol in the Mexican society.
Well, there was not much alcohol consumption among the Mexica for a couple of reasons. One, there wasn't much produced. The most widely produced form of alcohol was a beer, which is made from the syrup of the maguey plant, which in modern day Mexico we know as pulque. There it was known as neutle or nectar. And this is a very sweet nectar, which comes out of the head of the maguey, and it is allowed to naturally ferment. And it's pretty low in alcohol. I think most of it in Mexico these days runs, I think, around 3 or 4% alcohol. They did not have distillation. And so alcohol content was limited by the yeast, which was floating in the air, which did not provide much of a kick. Nonetheless, alcohol was restricted generally to ritual purposes. It was drunk at specific religious ceremonies. Individuals who were over 65, in essence, individuals who were no longer central to the productivity of the nation, were allowed greater leniency in imbibing alcoholic beverages. But young people in the prime of life, who were the heart of the society, were extremely envied against consumption of alcohol. Now, again, it's possible that some of this comes from the friars, who had a fear of drunkenness as part of Christian teachings. But it does seem that there is something within the Mexica culture which also looked askance on individuals who were inebriated, because they were no longer in touch with their senses. They were no longer in touch with the life that was going on around them.
Now, something I want to talk about as well before we talk about the conquistador is that there was another way to gain sacrificial victims as well, and that is the infamous ball game that they had playing. I don't remember what it's called out of my head, but they did the loser of the team, and of course, I believe, got sacrificed to the gods.
Not always. Not always. Many, many times we know the ball game was played, and it was played. It was played for ritual divination, that is to try and decide who would ultimately win a battle. It was used in a lot of other ritual ceremonies in which there was no execution. It was just a game. It's called Tlachtli in Nahuatl. The ball game is Tlachtli, and the ball court is the Tlachco. And it was, this game in various different forms was widespread throughout what we call Mesoamerica. That's everything from Central America up into the American Southwest. The Maya played a very, very similar game, and there are still games being played in Western Mexico, which have a great similarity to Tlachtli. Out there, they call it Ulama. So the ball game was very important. It was also a way of trying to understand the world and creativity, in that the Mexica saw the world as being pulled between opposing forces, and they saw that the ball game in many ways was a working out of opposing forces of two teams. And so it was also, it aided them in understanding the world in which they lived. Again, not always were the losers sacrificed. That did happen, we believe, from time to time, but not always.
So, of course, but I do believe people still play this game today, right? Certain part of Mexico. I'm hopefully minus the sacrifices.
Yeah.
I can only hope.
No, the Spaniards were pretty effective at getting rid of ritual executions early on, which they then, of course, replaced with their own ritual executions.
I do believe we covered some of this, but I want to talk a little bit about this at the end of the episode as well, because, of course, the Mexico and Andrés incoming to the world of the Mexico. And what was their reaction? Do we know if they witnessed sacrifice themselves when they entered Tuxtla, or how did... Of course, their reaction to and the abolition of the Aztec religion.
Oh yes, the conquistadores were very aware that these executions were going on. You have to remember that the Cortes expedition spent some 6 months in Mexico City before being kicked out on what the Spaniards called the Noche Triste. So they saw the different rituals and ceremonies that went on during the period of time that they were resident in Tenochtitlan. They had seen ritual executions in some of the other states that they passed through, Tlaxcala, Cholula, Huehotzingo, and others. So, no, they were very aware of the practice of ritual execution. And that's where the deep antipathy to it comes, is that the conquistadors see it and they associate it with the religious activity, and they think it's an abomination. So that's how it gets colored very, very quickly.
So I had something on my head right now, but do people still believe in... Yeah, something I wanted to end with, of course, is that I didn't believe this myth had been debunked today, but there is this myth going on that the Aztecs thought of the gods entering the city, that and that there was this... On the right time of the snake, I think, I don't remember exactly how the story goes, but that snake that came back to destroy the world, their world, or something like that. I don't remember the story on the top of my head, but yep. I do believe this again has been debunked pretty much, but they did not believe that they were gods, and that the snake came. That was added later, right?
Yep, yep. It's not a snake, it's Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent. And all of that is a bunch of hooey that was created by some of these friars and other Spaniards in the decade following the conquest. It has its roots in native belief systems and in native mythology, but which was then latched on by the Spaniards and exploited for their own benefits. When the Europeans arrived, the native peoples recognized them as being humans. They just had no idea where they came from. They were odd in the sense that they had animals that they'd never seen before, and that they had clothing that was quite strange, and they had metal tools, which by and large, the native peoples of central Mexico did not have. They had copper and they had some early forms of bronze, but they did not have iron and steel. So that was a surprise, but that's about it. I mean, it was a surprise. They knew they were people. They were talking to them. They negotiated with them, and they had battles, but no deities involved.
And I do believe we spoke a little about this in our episode on the conquistadores as well, but the Aztec always won over the Spaniards as well, and the Noche Triste, because even though they had guns and superior weapons, they weren't necessarily very reliable. So the Aztecs almost won against the conquistadores, if I know this correctly.
The Mexica, when you're talking about actual battle, the Mexica could have defeated the small number of Spaniards. When they drove them out of Tenochtitlan, they opted not to murder them, but to just kick them out and get the hell out of here and don't darken our door again. The key to success was that the Spaniards were not alone. They had already created alliances with the Tlaxcalans, who were, you know, a significant presence. And in fact, even in Tenochtitlan before and during the Noche Triste, it was not just the Spaniards that were getting kicked out. It was the Tlaxcaltecans also. And there were, we, you know, numbers are really tough to be accurate, but probably somewhere in the neighborhood of several thousand Tlaxcalan forces were with the Spaniards in Mexico City, Tenochtitlan. So it wasn't so easy to say that the Mexica could have killed all the Spaniards. Yeah, but you still have the Tlaxcalans. And it's not at all clear that who would have won that battle.
I think we've done a round up there. I hope that you got that clear, bit clearer idea of how the Aztec religion actually worked. Thank you so much for coming on. And before you go, do you have anything you want to promote? And where can people buy your book if they should be interested? Do you have any social media if people have any questions before you go that you want me to add to the description?
Sure, go ahead and buy the 15th month. It's I had a lot of fun writing it, and I think it's I wrote it in a way that individuals who were not specialists in the field could still understand the main points. The book that I had finished right before that was The First Letter from New Spain, in which I talk about all of the different members of the Cortez expedition. So in those two books, you get to see both sides of the world at the time of the conquest. You get to understand a little bit about the Mexica religion with the 15th month, and you get to understand about who were the members of the Cortez expedition when it landed in Veracruz back in 1519. So for me, at least, those are good companion pieces in that they talk about both sides right immediately prior to the confrontation.
Thank you again so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you on. And my name is Alan. We are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review of us. That would help us out a lot. If you are on Spotify, rate us 5 stars. And please, if you are on YouTube, please like, share, and subscribe, and leave a comment what you thought about this episode. Thank you so much for coming on. Please,
my pleasure.
Like, share, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.